ॐ नमः श्री अतिराजाय विवेकानन्दसूरये सचेत्सुखस्वरूपाय स्वामिने तपहारिणे. Our salutations to the great sage Swami Vivekananda, king of ascetics, the embodiment of existence, knowledge, and bliss, and the destroyer of misery. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
We have some very special guests this morning. My mother, you may remember during the temple opening, she was the one person who I think didn't miss a second. She sat through the whole thing. And my brother-in-law, Elliot, and two very dear family friends, Steve and Maxine. Very nice that they could come. And at least I know there'll be one person who enjoys the talk this morning. The topic this morning is the living God, and this is title of one of the most beautiful and powerful poems written by Swami Vivekananda. You know, this I'm kind of devoting this whole year, this 150th birth anniversary year, to different poems that Swamiji wrote. Some of them he wrote as poems, some of them were just portions of a letter. So it's hard to know if he wrote the poem and included it in the letter, or just it was a letter to Mary Hale. And he had this habit of writing poetry to Mary Hale, and she would write back in poetry also. So, and she was good. So we have some interesting correspondences between the two of them, just in poetry. But this is included in a very beautiful letter that Swamiji wrote to Mary Hale. The Hale family, of course, was the first family to take Swamiji in as their very own. It was they're really the one family that Swamiji felt most comfortable with. He looked upon the parents really as his own mother and father, and the two sisters and their cousins, there were four of them, he referred to them as the four sisters, as his very own sisters. So we find letters that Swamiji wrote, especially to Mary Hale, that are very sweet and very innocent. We don't see him as the great, big, powerful monk at that time. We see him just the fun-loving side and everything, but also he would open his heart and unburden himself to them as well. So it's very beautiful to look at the letters and poems that Swamiji wrote to Mary Hale. Let me first read, it's a very short poem. He who is in you and outside you, who works through all hands, who walks on all feet, whose body are all ye, him worship and break all other idols. He who is at once the high and the low, the sinner and the saint, both God and worm, him worship, visible, knowable, real, omnipresent, break all other idols, in whom is neither past life, nor future birth, nor death, in whom we always have been and always shall be one. Him worship, break all other idols. Ye fools who neglect the living God and his infinite reflections with which the world is full, while ye run after imaginary shadows that lead alone to fights and quarrels, him worship, the only visible, break all other idols. Swamiji wrote this poem at a particularly important and difficult time for him. Many of the poems we know, if we see them in context, we see that there was something deeply personal about them. This was a period when Swamiji's health was very poor. He had really exhausted himself, his 4 years of very hard work in the West. He had gone back to India. He composed this from Almora on July 9th, 1897. So shortly after he returned, after his first trip to the West. He went to Almora for some rest and some quiet time. Those of you who have been there know it's a beautiful place with beautiful view of the snow peaks and the Himalayas. He was there with some of his beloved brother disciples, Swami Sivananda, Yogananda, Niranjanananda, and some other monks of the order and some other devotees. And we know when Swamiji went back after this first trip, landing first in Colombo in Sri Lanka, then going to Rameshwaram and traveling all the way up to Elmora. He received a hero's welcome that no monk and perhaps no dignitary or political person ever received in India. It was a tremendous thing. So by the time, that also exhausted him. So by the time he got to Elmora, he desperately needed rest. Now, what we find in Swamiji's life is that whenever he became extremely popular, people started to slander him, especially, unfortunately, the Christian missionaries. And this happened at this particular time, including Dr. Barrows. Dr. Barrows was the chairman of the general committee that was behind the Parliament of Religions, where Swamiji was such a successful figure there. He came to India, and Swamiji arranged everything for him, wrote letters of introduction for everyone, so that he was received very warmly, and Dr. Barrows proceeded to slander Swamiji and criticize him and say that he said all sorts of things in the West, speaking against women, that he was of low caste, that he didn't represent Hinduism, all sorts of things. But Swamiji bore him no ill. He still received him very nicely. And at this time, when he should have been full of kind of anger and pessimism and everything, he wrote this beautiful poem, The Living God. And now, if you read the whole letter, this is the letter that contains possibly the most often quoted passage that Swamiji, one of the most important utterances that Swamiji meant, where he wrote, "And may I be born again and again and suffer thousands of miseries so that I may worship the only God that exists, the only God I believe in, the sum total of all souls. And above all, my God the wicked, my God the miserable, my God the poor of all races, of all species, is the special object of my worship." And then immediately after these lines, he wrote that poem. Now, this idea of God manifest in human form, this is not a new idea. We find it in the ancient scriptures, the ancient Vedic and Vedantic scriptures. There's a very beautiful description of this in the Bhagavad Gita, or Swami Brahmarupananji always quotes this one particular verse from chapter 13, Sarvata Panipadam Tat, Sarvato Kshishiro Mukham, Sarvata Shruti Malloke, Sarvam Avritya Tishtadi. With hands and feet everywhere, with eyes, heads, and mouths everywhere, with ears everywhere, he exists, pervading all. Now, what this really means is that it's really God himself walking on all feet, speaking through all mouths, hearing through all ears. This is the divine presence of God within, who is the real actor, the real enjoyer, the real self within all beings, and that this is the manifestation of God that is most tangible and visible for us, our very own self, and we see that same self in all beings. So this was not a terribly new idea, but we don't find it stressed and put into action the way that Swamiji did. This is the uniqueness of what Swamiji did. He understood the ramifications of this doctrine in a way that either wasn't understood before or wasn't followed through on before. So this was something that once Swamiji got this in his head, he had this tremendous desire to preach this, almost to trace this out as a new spiritual path. We hear about the Karma Yoga, where we're supposed to serve others in a spirit of selflessness and everything. But the old idea of Karma Yoga was that we did it, of course, to help others, but also to purify ourselves so that we would be able to go deep in meditation, we would be able to get rid of our bad karma and all of that. Swamiji emphasized this other side, that it's worship. That to serve someone else is a privilege for us, and it's worship, and this is the highest type of worship. So this was really a new path that Swamiji chalked out, we can say. So it's nothing less than the perfect conversion of service of mankind, converting service of mankind into worship of God. And we know that Swamiji was very clear that he wanted this to be an active force in the whole monastic order that he set up. So we know that now almost all of our centers will have, at the very least, a free dispensary. There'll be hospitals, there'll be orphanages and schools, that the monks of the order will be the first to show up wherever there's famine or flood, wherever there's any type of relief work that needs to be done. This is all because of Swamiji's ideal that this is worship, not just trying to help people in need, but worship of God dwelling in each and every human being, especially those in need. Now, the special feature of Swamiji's new path, we can say, is that though it's true God dwells equally in all beings, he saw some special manifestation of God in the poor and the uneducated, and those who needed the most help, those who were exploited, those who were outcast, those who were left behind from society. So he came up with this idea. We find in the Upanishads, Taittiriya Upanishad, there's a section which represents a kind of commencement ceremony where the teacher is telling the students, giving them their parting advice, Matri Devo Bhava, Pitri Devo Bhava, Acharya Devo Bhava, Atiti Devo Bhava. You should look upon your mother as God. You should look upon your father as God. You should look upon the teacher as God, and you should look upon the guest as God. Now, Swamiji added to this, Daridra Devo Bhava. I want you to look upon the poor as God in a very special way, the poor and downtrodden as God. And he used this expression, Daridra Narayana. We know that this term, Nara Narayana, is very commonly used. And Sri Ramakrishna actually used that. When he saw Swamiji the first time, he used this term, this Nararupa Narayana, this God in human form. So Swamiji took this Nara, and not just human form, Daridra. In this particular human form, those who are the most needy, the most forgotten in society. We hear sometimes that Swami Vivekananda had his own ways of doing things and his own ideas, and this wasn't the emphasis that we find in the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna. Even his brother disciples were a little bit befuddled when Swamiji started telling them to go out and work with the poor and all of that, because they'd heard from Sri Ramakrishna, the goal of life is to realize God. Turn within, go deep within, find that divinity within yourself and become transformed and become illumined and become free. But it was only because of the inspiration of Sri Ramakrishna that Swamiji started this, and that Swamiji really had this epiphany, we can say. And there were several reasons for this. Even with Sri Ramakrishna, he underwent a certain change, a change of heart. If we look at the history of his life and the different incidents that took place, we find different turning points. And one of these was when Sri Ramakrishna broke his arm. He was walking alone outside and had some vision. He used to go into ecstasy. He would see these visions of gods and goddesses and everything. He had some vision of Lord Jagannath in Puri, and he wanted to embrace that image, and he fell down and he broke his arm. Then later he said that, since my arm was injured, a deep change has come over me. I now delight only in the Nara Leela. That means the human manifestation of God. Nitya and Leela. Sri Ramakrishna used these terms to mean the absolute and the relative. The Nitya is the indivisible Satchidananda. That means the supreme absolute. And the Leela or sport takes various forms, such as the Leela of God, the Leela as the deities, the Leela as man, and the Leela as the universe. Vaishnava Charan used to say that one has attained perfect knowledge if one believes in God sporting as man. Then he says, I wouldn't admit it then, but now I realize that he was right. It is God alone who is sporting as man. So from that point on, this is 1884, Sri Ramakrishna didn't take that same delight in having visions of gods and goddesses and all of that. He liked to see God dwelling in human form, in devotees, and everyone that he saw. He would see the presence of the Divine Mother or the presence of Rama. And it depended on his frame of mind at that time. And we know he had this favorite expression, Tumi jano or na jano tumi Ram. He would say to the devotees, whether you know it or not, you're God incarnate. whether you know it or not, because we have no conception of that. We think we're ordinary human beings, that we just know about our physical birth and all of that. We're unaware of that presence of the divine within as our real self. And Sri Ramakrishna had that vision. He would see as if God himself were standing before him, taking all of these different forms. So this was a change that took place in Sri Ramakrishna. Now, how this change got transferred, we can say, to Swami Vivekananda, who was then Narendra. He was then a 20-year-old college student. It goes back to one particular conversation that took place. We've heard this story over and over and over again. But what's more interesting to me is Sri Ramakrishna's own reaction. Conversation was taking place about some of the different teachings of the Vaishnava community, and they were talking about this idea of jivedaya, compassion to all living beings. And sometimes Sri Ramakrishna would go into these funny moods. Something would trigger something, and his mind would go a little higher, and he would lose consciousness of the world. He would, God knows where his mind would go, and he would come down, and after he came down, and he would start speaking to the devotees, then we'd have some sense of what took place. So he said, "You talk of compassion for beings. Will you, who are nothing but little insects, bestow compassion on other beings? You wretch, who are you to bestow it? No, no, it is not compassion to living beings, but service to them as Shiva, as God." So he used this play on words with Jiva and Shiva. So now we know this is a very common thing that we have, that we should look upon the Jiva, the individual soul, as Shiva, the God manifest. So Sri Ramakrishna went on in this vein, and everyone else was listening, and everyone else thought, it's very interesting. But then when they left the room, Narendra and all of his friends were talking, and he said, "Wow, what did you hear what he said?" And they said, "No, what did he say?" He was the only one that really understood the impact, that understood the ramifications of this teaching. So he said, "What a wonderful light I have gotten from Thakur's words, Ramakrishna's words. If the Divine Lord ever grants me an opportunity, I'll preach everywhere this wonderful truth that I have heard today. I will preach this truth to the learned and the ignorant, to the rich and the poor, to the Brahmins and the Chandalas, to the outcasts." So this idea burned its way into Swamiji's brain. It became a passion with him. Really, just beneath the surface of everything that he did after that, we can really see it, the way he set up the whole Ramakrishna order, the work that he did in the West, when he went back to India. So this is the result of this great teaching of Sri Ramakrishna. But we also have to say that this was Swamiji's nature from the time he was a young boy. These transformations take place, but there has to be some stuff there in the first place. So even as a young boy, he had this unusual sympathy and love for everyone, but especially for the poor. We read about as a young boy, when these wandering monks and beggars would come, he would give away everything that he had, and even his clothes and things. And then his mother and father, they would get upset with him. And so if any time these wandering beggars came, wandering monks would come, they would lock him up in his room upstairs. And he would take his clothes and other things and throw them out the window. So even that didn't work. But one of the transforming events took place when Narendra's father passed away. And this was also that same period. This was also 1884. His father had been a very successful attorney. He made a lot of money, but he spent a lot of money. He was very liberal and open-minded, but carefree. And he had a big family that he supported, joint family. And a lot of his family members simply lived off of his earnings. They didn't earn anything themselves, and they wasted money. Some of them drank and did all sorts of other things, and he didn't seem to mind. But suddenly he died. He had some massive heart attack or stroke or something, and died right away. And it turned out that he had spent even more than he earned, that he was left the family in debt, and the very people, relatives that he had supported, turned against him. And they tried to take over the house. Actually, they tried earlier even. At that time, they were living in a rented house, but they had a whole lawsuit so that they could take over the whole house. And Swami Vivekananda Narendra, this still a college student, found himself responsible for the whole family. He was the oldest son. There were two younger brothers. He had sisters. And his mother, who, of course, had never earned any money. She was a hardworking woman, of course, but never earned any money. So everything was up to him. And it was a great lesson in life, because he found that people don't care much for you if when you're in trouble. Not just his relatives, but also some of his friends. A few tried to help. He also didn't like other people to know their real situation, where often they didn't have enough food to eat, and he would go without food completely so his mother and brothers and sisters could eat. He went in search of a job day after day, barefoot, and it took forever to find something, and nothing lasted very long. So he wrote, all of these false rumors starting to be spread about him, that he became an atheist, that he was saying this and that and hanging out with bad people and everything. And news got back to Sri Ramakrishna himself, who said, if you're going to talk that way about him, don't come here anymore. I'll never believe it. I know it's impossible for him. He was the only one who really stood by him the whole time. But Swamiji said, this first contact with the reality of life convinced me that unselfish sympathy was a rarity in the world. There was no place in it for the weak, the poor, the destitute. I noticed that those who only a few days earlier would have been proud to have helped me in any way now turned their face against me, though they had enough and some to spare. So this was a very rude awakening to Swamiji of the ways of the world and the reality of poverty and how people react in the face of poverty and whether they help others or don't help others. But it was of tremendous importance with regard to this transformation of his way of thinking, his understanding, and his future mission. Now, the second period of worldly education, we can say, took place after Sri Ramakrishna passed away, when the first monastery was started in Baranagar, and when the young monks of the order decided to take to the wandering life. The traditional wandering life of a monk in India meant that you traveled from place to place, you begged your food, you slept under a tree if necessary. It was a very austere, rigorous type of life. And they all had the desire to experience that, even though they were living in a dilapidated old building all together with great joy. They were willing to give up that joy of company of their brother monks to live this traditional type of life. In those days, to see a monk like Swami Vivekananda was something very rare. First of all, he was a striking figure, strikingly handsome and brilliant intellect, spoke fluent English, knew Sanskrit quite well, knew the scriptures, was fully conversant with all aspects of Western literature and history and science. So it was a very unusual thing. In those days, sadhus were generally uneducated, poor people. They just would wander off. They didn't care about this deep learning. Of course, there were many sadhus who were well-versed in the scriptures, but this was something rare to see someone like Swamiji. And as much as he tried to hide himself, he was invariably found out that there would be the rumor of this wonderful monk has come, and he would be invited sometimes to these royal palaces and to these very well-to-do people and to these great scholars and pundits and everything. So Swamiji experienced that. He experienced the highest type of wealth and privilege in India, and at the same time, sometimes he would simply wander and have nothing to eat and sleep under a tree and share his food with the poorest of the poor. He talks about periods as long as 5 days at a stretch where he had nothing to eat. And there were times when he practically starved to death, of course, wandering and no food and no drink. So he found himself seeing the tremendous extremes in India. He had a period where he stayed in the home of an outcast sweeper when he was in central India, and he loved the poor. Somehow He could relate to them in a very special way. And it seems that in many of these old cultures, the poor are really, they have a certain purity and simplicity to them. And Swamiji found that to be true and could identify with them that way. He found them to be the backbone of the country. And he was really won over by their sincerity, by their simple ways and habits. But this dire lack of, this dire poverty, lack of education, lack of proper food and clothing, all of this broke his heart. He was very soft-hearted. We know that tremendously soft-hearted. And what really bothered him was the utter indifference of the upper classes and the wealthy people. And he used to say that, "I consider every man a traitor who, having gotten wealth and everything on the backs of these poor people, does nothing to help them." So he, this was something that was a very deep conviction with him, that these people had to be helped somehow. And this represented, of course, the masses of India. So we find in Swamiji's writings, in his lectures, he was constantly talking about these two things, privilege and exploitation. He couldn't bear these two things, and the conviction came to him that somehow he was born to do something to help the underclasses of India to regain their individuality and to regain their self-respect. So this became, a real passion with him. Now, Swamiji was traveling through all over India when he heard about this big event that was taking place in Chicago, this Parliament of Religions that took place in 1893. This idea came into his head that perhaps this was an opportunity for him, that he could do two things, really. He could spread these wonderful liberal teachings of Sri Ramakrishna to the West, and at the same time, perhaps he could raise some funds, raise some interest in the West for people to help India with education, with technology, even just with money. Before Swamiji left for the West, he happened to meet some of his brother disciples, and Swami Turiyananda was there. This was, I believe, either in Bombay, Mumbai, or Mount Abu. Anyhow, before he left Bombay by ship. So we have a very beautiful reminiscence by Swami Turiyananda. He says, "I vividly remember some remarks made by Swamiji at that time, the exact words and accents and the deep pathos with which they were uttered still ring in my ears. He said, 'Hari Bhai,'" that was Swami Turiyananda's name, Hari, "'Hari Bhai, I am still unable to understand your so-called religion.' Then, with an expression of deep sorrow on his countenance and intense emotion shaking his body, he placed his hand on his heart and added, 'But my heart has expanded very much, and I've learned to feel. Believe me, I feel intensely indeed.' His voice was choked with feeling. He could say no more. For a time, profound silence reigned, and tears rolled down his cheeks." In telling of this incident, Swami Turiyananda was also overcome. He sat for a while, his eyelids heavy with tears. With a deep sigh, he said, "Can you imagine what passed through my mind on hearing the Swami speak thus? Are not these, I thought, the very words and feelings of Buddha? I could clearly perceive that the sufferings of humanity were pulsating in the heart of Swamiji. His heart was a huge cauldron in which the sufferings of mankind were being made into a healing balm." So Swamiji came to the United States. We know he was a tremendous success at the Parliament of Religions. He was lionized from all quarters. Still, he never forgot. He never forgot. In fact, probably remembered them even more, the poor and suffering people back in India. There were times when he was living with very wealthy people, and when he saw the wealth in the West, when he saw the social work that was done here, it really pained him so much to think that nothing was being done in India. So we find him writing letters back to his brother disciples, back to his own disciples, especially those from Madras, the ones who had helped him, helped send him to the West. Alasinga, Gideon, and others, and also those who were in a position to do something. He had disciples who were big shots. These are the Maharaja of Khetri and the Maharaja of Mysore, who had a lot of money and a lot of power and influence. But especially he wrote to his brother disciples, his Swami Akandananda, Ramakrishnananda, and Brahmananda, Swami Shivananda. If you go through the letters of Swami Vivekananda, you'll see what tremendous passion he had in writing to his brother disciples. When he traveled back in India on that tour from Colombo to Alamora, he spoke about this to his countrymen. He spoke about it from the platform in the West. He gave a very beautiful and powerful series of lectures on practical Vedanta. These are the four lectures given in London. And in one of these he said, "The living God is within you, and yet you are building churches and temples and believing all sorts of imaginary nonsense. The only God to worship is the human soul and the human body. Of course, all animals are temples too, but man is the highest, the Taj Mahal of temples. If I cannot worship in that, no other temple will be of any advantage. The moment I have realized God sitting in the temple of every human body, the moment I stand in reverence before every human being and see God in him, that moment I am free from bondage. Everything that binds vanishes, and I am free." So Swamiji had this very passionate plea to his brother disciples to encourage the people of India to sacrifice everything. Sometimes he said, just give me a small band, give me a handful of people. Sometimes he said, I want thousands to do this. But he had this conviction that this is something that that could be done and that that had to be done. Now, his brother disciples, as I said, were a little bit skeptical in the beginning, but they knew that Sri Ramakrishna had entrusted everything to Narendra, Swami Vivekananda, and he had told them, you follow him in everything. So they knew that. They had that faith, even though they didn't fully understand everything that Swamiji did and all the motives behind it, but they had that faith and they followed him. Now, the one exception, or we can say at least the first to take up this idea, who didn't need much persuading, was Swami Akandananda. And it was just his birthday day before yesterday. Swami Akandananda was one of the dearest brother disciples of Swamiji. He loved all of them, of course, but he had some special affection for Swami Akandananda. And the Swami Akandananda had also this tremendous heart. He used to recite a Sanskrit verse that says, "I do not desire a great kingdom, heavenly pleasure, or freedom from rebirth. I desire the destruction of all afflictions for all living beings, suffering from the fire of misery." The Swami was very fearless. He traveled on foot back and forth to Tibet several times. His life was in danger. There's so many interesting stories about how dacoits got a hold of him and were ready to kill him. And even one time, just because he had this desire to start a school for the outcast children, there were people, higher caste people, who were so infuriated that they tried to kill him even. So, but he didn't mind anything. So he was very bold that way. Swamiji wrote a beautiful letter to him. This was also in 1894. "Go from door to door amongst the poor and lower classes of the town of Khetri," this is in the central part of India, "and teach them religion. Also, let them have oral lessons on geography and such other subjects. No good will come of sitting idle and having princely dishes and saying, 'O Ramakrishna, O Lord,' unless you can do some good to the poor. Go to other villages from time to time and teach the people the arts of life as well as religion, work, worship, and knowledge. First work, and your mind will be purified. Otherwise, everything will be fruitless, like pouring oblations on a pile of ashes, instead of in the sacred fire. When Gunaniti," I don't know who this is, "when Gunaniti comes, move from door to door of the poor and the destitute in every village of Rajputana. If people object to the kind of food you take, give it up immediately. It is preferable to live on grass for the sake of doing good to others. The Gerwa robe is not for enjoyment. It is the banner of heroic work. You must give your body, mind, and speech to the welfare of the world. You have read, and now this is that reference to Taittiriya Upanishad, Matri Devo Bhava, Pitri Devo Bhava, look upon your mother as God, look upon your father as God. But I say, Daridra Devo Bhava, Murkha Devo Bhava. The poor, the illiterate, the ignorant, the afflicted, let these be your God. Know that service to these alone is the highest religion. The one achievement that Swami Akandananda is best known for, of course, is the orphanage that he started in Sargachi in West Bengal. This was actually the first branch of Bellarmut, of the Ramakrishna order established in India. The first that was established in the world was in New York in 1894. This was even before the order was officially started and everything. But the first in India was this Sargachi. This was in the Murshidabad district, and there was a terrible famine. This is in 1897. The cattle were dying, people were dying, and generally people will feed their children first, then they'll die, then the children will be orphans. So there were orphans all over the place, and no one to look after them. And he was just a wandering sadhu. He happened to be there at the time. And when he saw this, he knew that he had to do something. So he devoted his whole life to these poor orphan boys and girls, and would refuse to take any food, any more food than he could provide for them. And really, his brother monks were afraid that he would starve himself to death. So even money was sent from as far away as Madras, from Swami Ramakrishnananda. They all wanted to help him in this work. So he worked tirelessly for the famine-stricken villagers, and many of whom were Muslim. He made no difference to him whatsoever, whether they were Hindu or Muslim children. And he started this orphanage in this nearby town of Sargachi. The work was first started in this village of Mahula, but then in Sargachi. And he loved these children as his very own. The villagers, they all loved him. They called him Dandi Baba, because he used to carry a stick. So this Dandi father, they looked upon him really as their own father. So he started this orphanage, he started a school for them. He looked after the village people. He nursed them when they were sick. And of course, he gave them these wonderful liberal teachings of Sri Ramakrishna at the same time. So little by little, once this small band of monks, the brother disciples of Swami Vivekananda, got a taste of this joy of worshiping the living God in this way, it wasn't long before they all took it up. And this work of education and service and relief became a regular and indispensable feature of the Ramakrishna order as envisioned by Swamiji. This is exactly what he wanted. Now there's a nice little irony that the place where Swamiji expressed this idea of the living God best, I think, in India, was a place of the highest ritual and orthodoxy. That's the temple of Rameshwaram. Yeah, when Swamiji went back to India, as I said, he first landed in Sri Lanka, and then the first place he landed in India was just the port city near this Rameshwaram, and he went to the temple there. And he was received, the hero's welcome when he was there, and practically worshiped. Now, one thing we have to understand is that at that time, people from the West had a terrible opinion of the Indians. They looked down upon them, especially the British who were in India, so that the Indians felt that they were really nothing but worms, that they were told they were idolaters, and they had the worst sort of superstitions and everything, and they started to believe it. When they saw someone from their country, Indian, who would go to the West and receive such adulation and praise and everything, that gave them such pride that they really looked upon Swamiji as a patriot and a hero, and as well as a great religious figure. So when he got to Rameshwaram, a huge crowd was there to welcome him. He was given a very nice address of welcome, and then was asked to reply to that address of welcome. And part of what he said is, this is the gist of all worship, to be pure and to do good to others. He who sees Shiva. Shiva is because it's a Shiva temple, but it means who sees God. Who sees Shiva in the poor, in the weak, and in the diseased, really worshipped Shiva. And if he sees Shiva only in the image, his work is but preliminary. Now, he's saying this in a place where this image of worship is being done in the most orthodox possible way, and with the greatest feeling of the sacred and reverence and everything. This was his boldness, and nobody minded, nobody objected. The wonderful thing is that if you go there, and I went there in 2005, it was a wonderful experience, and it was actually thrilling when I first saw it. These words were engraved on both sides of the main gate to the Rameshwaran temple in some bronze plaque. Yeah, in such an orthodox place, which is really not criticizing this image worship, but half. Anyhow, let me go back to this. He who served and helped one poor man, seeing Shiva in him, without thinking of his caste or creed or race or anything, with him Shiva is more pleased than with the man who sees him only in temples. A rich man had a garden and two gardeners. One of these gardeners was very lazy and did not work. But when the owner came to the garden, the lazy man would get up and fold his hands and say, "How beautiful is the face of my master," and dance before him. The other gardener would not talk much, but would work hard and produce all sorts of fruit and vegetables, which he would carry on his head to his master, who lived a long way off. Of these two gardeners, which would be the more beloved of his master? Shiva is that master, and this world is his garden. And there are two sorts of gardeners here. The one who is lazy, hypocritical, and does nothing, only talking about Shiva's beautiful eyes and nose and other features. And the other who is taking care of Shiva's children. All those that are poor and weak, all animals and all his creation. Which of these would be the more beloved of Shiva? Certainly he that serves his children. He who wants to serve the father must serve the children first. He who wants to serve Shiva must serve his children, must serve all creatures in this world first. It is said in the scriptures that those who serve the servants of God are his greatest servants. So you will bear this in mind. Let me tell you again that you must be pure and help anyone who comes to you as much as lies in your power. And this is good karma. By the power of this, the heart becomes pure, and then Shiva, who is residing in everyone, will become manifest. He is always in the heart of everyone. If there is dirt and dust on a mirror, we cannot see our image. So ignorance and wickedness are the dirt and dust that are on the mirror of our hearts. Selfishness is the chief sin. Thinking of ourselves first. He who thinks, "I will eat first, I will have more money than others, and I will possess everything." He who thinks, "I will get to heaven before others, I will get freedom, mukti, liberation before others," is the selfish man. The unselfish man says, "I will be last. I do not care to go to heaven. I will even go to hell if by doing so I can help my brothers." This unselfishness is the test of religion. He who has more of this unselfishness is more spiritual and nearer to Shiva. Whether he is learned or ignorant, he is nearer to Shiva than anybody else, whether he knows it or not. And if a man is selfish, even though he has visited all the temples, seen all the places of pilgrimage, and painted himself like a leopard, he is still further off from Shiva. So we see, if we look back over the past 120 years, Swamiji was 30 years old. This is 150th birthday when he went to the Parliament of Religions. And just, you know, from a few years earlier, when Swamiji said, "If I ever get the opportunity, I'll preach this throughout the world," that he did it, that he got that opportunity. And he did present really a new spiritual vision. And we see it in India. This is really a wonderful thing to see. Almost every spiritual tradition, almost every community in India, almost every great spiritual leader will have some type of a hospital or dispensary or something. Now, this wasn't the case earlier. wasn't the case before. This is all the influence of Swamiji and the tremendous work that's done by the order, of course. We know that this is all due to his tremendous effort. Now, we shouldn't think that he was against traditional types of worship also, that he understood the value of prayer and worship and temple worship and everything else, but this was a very special message that he wanted to give. If we neglect this type of worship, seeing God in all beings, and only do that other type, then we won't get much benefit out of it. But if we do this type of worship, we don't need anything else. So this was something that was very, very important in Swamiji's life. For Swamiji, this was the real worship of the living God, who works through all hands, who walks on all feet, whose body are all ye. Him worship and break all other idols.
Mrityorma amritam gamaya abhiravirmaiti rudrayate dakshanam mukham te namam pahi nityam. Om shanti 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 harihi om tatsat. Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness to light. Lead us from death to immortality. Light us through and through, O Lord, and protect us evermore with thy compassionate face. Om peace, peace, peace be unto all.